Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage, the podcast. Today, I will be playing the part of Chet Haas from the Android UI Toolkit team.
I'm still Tornover over from the Android Tools team, and we have two guests today.
Two!
Hi, I'm George Mount from the Android UI Toolkit team.
And I'm Yid Boyer from the Android UI Toolkit team.
So you can see, when we run out of ideas, we just grab people from our teams. I don't even know what these guys do, but they were, in the hallway.
Actually, we're here to gang up on Tor.
Yes, although you work on stuff that is highly related to tools, so I'm, not feeling too bad about this.
Oh, maybe I'm in the minority, because you're going to talk about data and you're going to talk about tools, and that's just not my strong suits. So what are we going to talk about? Let's talk about data binding.
Data binding.
All right. Well, it was a good podcast. Thanks for coming. So Yeet and George were behind the data binding stuff that was previewed with the preview release at Google I.O. this year and will be in the M release and in the tools. So we thought we would find out more about that today. So why don't we start with what the hell do you mean?
Data binding is a way to get your data from your data model into your UI with using just markup language in your layout XML. So it will bind to it, and whenever the changes to your data happen, it will automatically update your UI. It's a way to make your... Yeah, magically. It's a way to make your app a lot easier to write and a lot more robust, less code, less bugs. It's great.
When you say less bugs, how come it's less bugs?
Well, a lot of the stuff we're eliminating is the glue logic that you normally do when you're writing your application. So you normally have to say find view by ID, set the data on that view, and let's imagine that you have two different layouts. And in one layout, you have some data element, some UI element, and you do find view by ID, and then you set the data. But in let's say you're in your landscape view, you have a different layout, and you don't have that view. Now you have to do an if to see if that that view exists, and then set the view element data only when that view exists.
I see. So it's handling null crashes.
Yeah.
And I thought I heard something about threading as well. What's the threading issue around plumbing?
So normally you have to update your UI in a UI thread lad, and it's always like lots of callbacks you have to handle. And then you need to be careful about your activity lifecycle or your fragment lifecycle, and we take care of it for you. So you can dispatch anything. Like, you can change your data in whichever thread you want. We are going to batch these updates and update your UI in the next animation frame.
I see. So you make setters that are thread safe? So
yes,
I can say, hey, set the price to 50, and then it's just going to do the right thing, and the UI will update sometime later.
Yeah, whenever possible. In the next animation frame, you will see the update.
And then you also create all the listeners, right? Like, you're basically eliminating a lot of boilerplate code.
Exactly,
people have the callbacks.
That's the best part. Like, there's a lot of code usually you have to write. And, I mean, it's very easy code to write, but that's the part where you make the most unexpected mistakes. So we do it for you. We write the listeners.
We make the mistakes for you.
Yeah, well, those are expected
Yeah, we
mistakes,
also
though.
Do the mistakes. Yeah. But then it's our bugs, and we fix them.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, sometimes.
So how does this work? So I get to use some sort of markup, you said, and somehow there's plumbing code. Do I run a wizard and I get like tons of classes in my project that I have to edit, or how does what
wizard?
So
obviously, the tools person.
It's
a dialogue.
It's really an anti-pattern to use wizards, but anyway, I'm hoping that's not actually the answer.
It's called the Gradle, the Great White Wizard. we work with him. It's right now it works on top of Gradle, where we go and so in your XML files is the same Android XML layouts, except a little bit tiny difference where you can put expressions in places. So instead of just referencing make text these text like strings, blah blah, you put them inside an expression which we parse. So at compile time we go under like read these XML layouts, try to figure out what you are referring there, verify them. And then match it with your code base. So if you refer something like I put user.name there, we try to go figure out, okay, what does this user mean? Find that object, understand how we can acquire that data. And then from both of these information, we create binding classes, which are the code you would normally write if you were not using data binding. We just write that code, except it's probably much more efficient than you would write because a machine writing the code. But yeah, basically, this like there is no black magic. It's all well defined. Like part of the compile process.
But it's happening in build time. Yes. So this is not code that I maintain.
Yes.
So it's right. So it's just like the resource compiler, like the R class then, right? So I build, like I can refer to it. I can refer to the R class, but it's not a class that I write and it gets updated automatically.
Exactly.
So you get, so what is that class called that you, is there, I guess it's a set of classes?
Yeah, it's per each layout file, you get one class. I mean, if you have the same layout file in different configurations, for each configuration, you get a different implementation, but we provide you one interface. So you actually don't need to care about the configurations.
So if I have a layout called main, what classes do I get from the data binding?
You get main binding.
Main binding. Yeah. Okay.
But you can also name it whatever you want. We have an option you can in your layout file. You can say, oh, set the name to be this because I don't want to have it in this package, or I want to have a different package, or I want to have a different name because main binding is maybe not interesting enough for you. You want to call it something else. Hmm.
So speaking of layout files, you also introduced the concept of sort of a higher level layout file, right, where you can declare these sort of things?
That's right. Normally the root tag is in the layout file is the root of your view hierarchy. But in this case, we have a new root tag, which is called layout. And one of the elements is a data element, which lets you define all the variables that you're going to use, and maybe some imports, kind of like a Java import. Okay. If you want to use, say, view as a class in your expression, you want to say view.invisible. If you want to set the visibility to visible or invisible, depending on some field, you can do that. And then another element is the root of your view hierarchy.
Okay, so the old layout files, the traditional layout files, basically become a node inside the new layout.
Exactly.
Layout
correct.
File.
Yeah.
The
so
layout file
demote
with the
them.
Layout tag.
What are the steps I have to follow if I want to add data binding? So obviously you just mentioned that I wrap my layout in a new layout tag.
Yeah.
What else?
You need to add the Gradle plugin you say apply plugin to that Gradle plugin, and that's it.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a com.android.
So I go in my build.gradle file, and where it already applies the Android plugin.
Yep.
There's an extra apply plugin line that you add?
No, you just need to add the SDK to your class path so that it can find the plugin dependencies.
Okay.
That's pretty much. And then the plugin itself adds dependencies to your project, but you don't need to worry about them.
Okay.
We saved you some steps by saying, applying the dependencies that you need. But essentially, okay. it supplies you with a few small runtime libraries that we use that are the basis for all of your binding classes that are common code everywhere.
And that's so that you don't have to generate them.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
We don't want to generate the same code for every layout file. We'd rather just have a common base class for those.
So the expressions that you talked about, this is more than simply setting a value, right? It's like a little, it's not a mini language, but it's sort of a subset of the syntax you would expect.
Yeah, you can think it's like a subset of Java. We wanted to be really careful, like not to allow you too much there. It's important, like expressions are really a convenient way to set what you want. And then as the example George gave, like, sometimes I want to make this badge visible if the user has more than 20 reviews. Like, it's very simple logic. You can put it there. But that shouldn't be complex. Like, we don't allow you to allocate anything.
So more like ternary expressions.
Yeah, you can just do ternary and simple expressions. And then we added like a couple of convenient ways to access stuff. Like, you can access list as if they're array with the bracket notation.
But just to make this more concrete, in the example you just mentioned, right, I have some sort of icon badge that I want to make visible if there's more than 20 reviews.
Yeah.
So would I then set the visible attribute of the image view or whatever to, and then I would have an expression inside the value there, so instead of saying true or false, or I guess visible and gone, I guess would be the right values. You're saying I would then do some sort of data binding expression?
Yeah.
What would that look like? Let's say that we have a main binding class somewhere, and we've bound the number of views, like the number of views in my activity. What is it that I would put in this expression?
So in your layout file, you would have a variable number of reviews.
Okay.
And you define this, like you say this is an integer. And then in the expression, you say view.visible, and then if number of views is greater than 20, view.visible, else we have that gone.
This is a question colon, so it's a ternary operator.
Ternary operator.
We don't support if then, if else.
Yeah.
Okay, that seems really straightforward. So I guess it's higher in the layout file, where you define this variable, that I guess that's where you perform sort of the actual binding part of the data binding.
Exactly. I mean, you need to, for your layouts, you need to define which data it needs. Like, we don't want it to become way too magical on, like, whatever you can set. And then
things are kind of magical now with like, on-click handlers, right? So you say on-click, right. And it just knows that, hey, whatever activity you're in should have a method with the same name. That's pretty magical. Here, I guess it sounds much more explicit in that you're saying this variable is exactly referring to this other thing.
So that's in the attribute. So you say in your, say, image view, you'd say Android visibility is equal to your expression. It's still kind of magical in that you don't really see the code that goes behind that. Mm-hmm. But it's all being compiled into a class that finds the view that you're looking for and then applies the logic to that.
Yeah,
view.
If you want to one-to-one compare with the existing on-click handlers on views, if you rename the method in your activity, it's going to crash at runtime. If you were using data binding, if you did the same, if you rename the method, it's not going to compile. Like, unless we can verify that you're going to find that method, it's going to crash at compile time.
And that's because you're turning these expressions into actual Java code.
Exactly.
So there's no way for me to have a syntax error that I just ignored.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that, I guess that means that you have no performance penalty either. This is not runtime interpreted code. This is not like JavaScript that gets like evaled. This is actually as if you wrote the code yourself.
Yeah, that's right.
Actually, we even do more than that. So when let's say your data changes, right? Data binding already, so if you use the same expression, like same sub-expression mm-hmm. in multiple expressions in the same layout file. So I say in multiple places I called user.get full address, which concatenates some strings.
Yep.
If I use it in multiple places, it's going to evaluate it only once and reuse that local variable to set the other ones.
Hmm.
And moreover, like, of course, this is good practice, but if you were writing this code by hand, you would not do that. It's like it's too much local variables. Then
I mean, the risk is like, these are currently the same, but they're not logically tied to each other. And so if you extract it, then all of a sudden you have two places that might not be correct anymore if you wanted to change one.
So what we, on top of that, what we do is when you invalidate your data, we calculate what we should recalculate. So we are not going to reset all of your views and set everything from scratch. We are going to only set views that has changed. And we only evaluate those expressions. So to
make this back to our badge example, mm-hmm. so if I then in the activity decide to say, okay, the number of reviews is now 75,
mm-hmm.
I call some setter, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and that will automatically then do whatever magic necessary for the layout to be updated?
Yeah, exactly. And it's going to only update that image view, nothing else.
So there's a couple of things there. One is if you have a variable for your layout, in this case, for your binding, and if your number of reviews is a variable for your layout, then you actually have to explicitly call set the variable on your binding. But you can also have an object, like a model object, that has a field or a Java Beans field that you set the variable on. And then if you implement the observability interface, then we will know whenever you change that field. For example, if you get the data from some server somewhere, we'll know that when you update that, maybe in a background thread, that we'll automatically update the UI to
match that. So observability, is that something from your runtime library?
That's right. That's the observable interface is something that we supply.
How big is this runtime library? How many, a lot of Android developers are concerned about the 64K method limit. So I'm wondering, what's the price of, it sounds like there's no performance price.
It's more than
63K. It's actually very tiny.
Yeah, it's very tiny.
Yeah.
So we are very careful about that. Even in the code we generate, we try not to create any methods if it is not necessary. For example, for the views, so we try to provide you easy access to those views.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of providing getters, we create public final fields that you can instantly access.
Yeah. So we kind of skipped this, but you don't have to do find view by ID anymore. Any view with an ID is automatically assigned a public field for that view. So instead of having a getter for it, you have a public field for that view.
The second I set an ID, that means that you're going to interpret that as, hey, someone needs to look this up.
Yep.
And therefore, you're going to put it in the field right away.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, that's cool.
So back to the code that's being generated. So one of the concerns when the project started out, I think, in the team is like, in the framework team and the toolkit team, like, we tend to be really sensitive about the amount of overhead we're incurring because we are the inner loop of applications, right? Mm-hmm. So there was a fair amount of effort put toward doing everything at build time, like generating all the code and being just as efficient as people would be in their own setters, assuming they're being efficient in their setters, right? So we're actually generating all the code and we call directly into setters as opposed to, like, doing things through reflection, which we absolutely want to avoid, mm-hmm. right? So just wanted to call that out, that, like, this is one of the concerns that I think people have when they hear about this kind of feature. But in fact, a lot of the work that went into the feature was done specifically to avoid that overhead.
Yeah, that was like our number one priority, right?
Yep. Number one priority.
Yeah. Has to be fast.
And backwards compatible.
Yeah, we that was the hard part of the...
Yeah, yeah. It's easy to write a new framework element, but then to make it actually work on support library or work on... We go all the way down to version 7, so it's...
7?
It's pretty exciting.
Wow. I think Play Services is 9, right? So...
Oh.
Well, I could be wrong about that, but that was my impression.
So back to the example you were talking about where you had, you know, number of reviews. So in the metadata, in your layout file, you're going to say, I have this variable number of reviews, and then you're going to check against that variable. So declaring that allows you to use it in the expression in your view hierarchy, right? When
Correct.
You're actually doing the data binding expression. But where does that get assigned? Like, what does that variable refer to? How do you communicate
normally
that?
Today, if you write a layout file without data binding, the first thing you write in your activity is set content view, and then you pass a layout, right, to initialize your activity's content.
Yeah.
So instead of doing that, you say data binding utility set content view, you pass your activity and your layout ID. And we are going to return you a binding class. It's a generated class that is going to have a set number of reviews method. So then you set the number of reviews on that one.
So instead of having fields locally from your findViewById calls, you now just typically have a binding object. That's exactly. The thing that you create in your onCreate. And whenever you want to refer to something like getters or setters, mm-hmm. or I guess not getters, but setters.
We provide getters as well. But you can if you have a variable for your layout, it will be on the binding class.
Okay.
Yeah. Most of the time, so in a more realistic example, what you would have is like you would have a view model that represents the data there. So in your layout file, it will just say, I have a variable called data, and this is this class.
Oh, I see.
So
you can
view model class.
So you can already have your existing data structure.
Exactly.
And you can do a pretty simple, straightforward mapping from that to the UI.
Yeah, you can even like put your user data structure, whatever you have there, you can just declare it as a variable. So let's say you are writing a profile activity that shows the profile of a user. In your layout file, you say, I have a variable called user, and the class name is com example user, and then the binding class we will generate will have a set user method, and that's it. So we will find the method, like if the user has a number of recommendations field, you can access it now. You don't need to declare every single thing you are going to access.
Okay, so I think that was actually the answer to the question that I was asking was, what do we declare a number of reviews, but how does it know what that refers to? So you're actually saying the declaration is, you know, here's the variable name, and it refers to this class.
Exactly. Yeah. You need to define it.
And one of the things we're doing is avoiding reflection at runtime, but we are doing some sort of reflection actually using the annotation processor at compile time. And the nice thing about the annotation processor at compile time is we actually know things like the generics, the actual type of the generics at compile time, so we can do things with that as well.
Oh, interesting, because you wouldn't know them at runtime, so we actually have more information at build time than we would at runtime anyway. Nice.
So that's how, if I have some sort of user object, that was your example, right, and I have like name and address, mm-hmm. we would use, I guess, a reflection might not, yeah, I guess reflection to find out what the properties are, the Java Beans properties, and we turn those into sort of properties that you can bind to?
No, you don't need to define, yes, I mean, in your expression, so if you define your user, in your expression, you could say user.name plus.
I see, and that turns into, you then interpret that as, aha, that is referring to this setter on the user object, because you used a, you know, lowercase person name, and that maps to this setter over there by the setter pattern.
So
That's right.
Process is like, we parse that expression, okay, is valid grammar, yes, is valid grammar, then something like that will be like, okay, I have a left expression, right expression, and a plus. So I have something that I merge. Then we recursively go through this, when it comes to user.name, we look, okay, what is this user? We know it refers to the variable you defined. And then what does this name mean? And then we go to that user class, figure out what, like, is this name get name method or is it a public name field?
Right.
We try to find it, and if we can find it,
so it's basically Java Beans without the performance penalty.
Right, and we're fairly flexible in the interpretation of the expression. For example, user.name could be user.getName, for example,
yeah,
or it could be a public field, user.name. And we will use it either way, whatever way you want. It could be a public static field. It would still be fine. And it's even it's a public method called name.
And so I assume you also look for is for Booleans?
Yes.
The one that always bothers me when I'm trying to name things properly is there sometimes is just wrong and get is wrong, and really has is the right prefix. Would you consider also looking for has?
We could consider that. We don't right now, but we should consider it. I know that the reason I didn't include it is because it's not part of the Java Beans.
That is true. Yeah. I'm not saying you should, but I'm saying that there are times when I'm like, oh, this doesn't smell right.
It doesn't smell right. That's right.
Yeah, I think I when that happens, I put it like the variable name has the has. And then the getter actually has the same variable name just as a method.
Get has?
No, it's like user has any friends.
I agree, but the part that you're exposing to people looking at your API is the poorly named thing, not your nicely named private field.
But you name your method the same with your private field. No one sees your private field. So then
I'm saying it's the method that has to be named is or get. You don't have the luxury of calling it has, right? Then you're violating the bean spec. So that's what I'm saying. Like sometimes, I'm sort of torn. Like this is a Boolean getter. I probably should name this is, but there's certain verbs that don't work right with that.
Yeah.
Or verbs, not the
that's right. Why we you're match right. Exactly. We don't enforce you to put get or is in front of it. You can actually use the same name too.
Oh,
yeah. So
and that sometimes feels right, actually, to have more terse APIs where you really just have the property itself named.
Yep.
That's good. Okay, yeah,
So you could use has, but you'd have to use has as your user.has whatever instead of user.whatever.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the observable thing. So you talked about the developer implementing the observable interface so that data would then be propagated and go through the data mining system. But do they need to, or is that done implicitly? Like when they declare a variable that points to a class, I assume that you're implementing observable so that you can actually propagate that information automatically. Like I'm trying to get a sense for how much they do through writing the expressions and the variables in their XML and how much they need to do to take advantage of data binding actually in Java code that they're writing.
Okay. So if you don't implement the observable interface, then what's going to happen is we're going to bind to your data and just bind it once. And we won't know if you make changes behind the scene. There's no way for us to understand that. But if you want to take advantage of the automatic updates, then you have to implement this interface. And you can do that in a few ways. One is to extend the base observable class. And that's a little intrusive for some people. They want to have a model that they have in their own application. And so we don't require that. The other way to do it is to implement an interface, the observable interface. And essentially what it is, it's register for the listener and then add the listener remove the listener. And then you have to actually notify the listener yourself. So you have to handle all that stuff.
Actually, we also provide the helper class to do that.
Yeah.
So you could technically just say, if you don't want to extend base observable, you can say, okay, I implement observable, get an instance of this public class we provide, and every call you receive through the observable interface, you just forward it to this class. And it's going to work.
But every time you have a change, you also have to notify that listener, the set of listeners. That's right. There's also some other things. We've seen some applications that have kind of more amorphous data, and they've just put it in some kind of map. And we also support that. We have an observable map, essentially. And you can just put it in this blob set of data. And then whenever a change happens, you just set the field, and it will do that for you.
Is that has amorphous data or is amorphous data?
it could be either, yes.
Okay. So do you handle lists specially, or is it using that generic facility? And in general, with the recycler view, if items are reused, how does data binding work then?
So, I mean, so when the recycle view starts, data binding stops, basically. Recycle view does. So we thought about this, right? It's very common that you want to have a list. You want to show the list.
I want to bind items from my user items, right? Exactly. I want to have number of views tied to the number of stars that I'm showing.
The way you would do it is, like, we have something called, okay, I'm not going into that detail, but you basically, in your layout file, you can say, I have a recycler view. The layout measure is the linear layout measure, which you can already do. And you can say data is this array, user.friends. That's it. That friends is a list of users.
And then recycler view handles the rest.
Pretty much. I mean, there's a very convenient way to do that, but it's hard to explain it right now. But basically, we have something called adapters, where you can write a method in your code, in your custom code, that says, okay, I know how to handle these attributes. This is actually one of the side advantages of data mining that people loved, where you can say that I know how to handle data attribute on recycler view class. So the way you say it is, you have a static method, you annotate it, say that this is a binding adapter. Say the first parameter is a recycler view, and then in the annotation you say the name of the attribute is data, and the type is a list. You just say this. At compile time, when we see that expression in the XML, once we don't know how to do it, like we don't know how to set data on recycler view because the recycler view doesn't have such method, we find your data adapter. We realize, oh, this thing knows how to handle this. And at runtime, we are going to call your method with whatever data is passed and recycler view instance. So you kind of say, I know how to bind this.
Okay, so I would write one of those and I would have some sort of callback where I can say, okay, here's this reusable item. Now I need to set, you know, these three items inside my item layout. And then it'll work when the user is scrolling the recycler view. How do you know so much about recycler view?
Say it again.
So how do you know so much about recycler view?
I heard that's very well used. I think I know who develops it mostly.
Close personal connection. So we could segue into talking about recycler view, but before we do, so I wanted to talk about how people get this thing, because it's not a typical framework feature in that it's really more of a tools feature with some pieces in the support library, right? So we talked about it as part of the M preview at Google I.O., but people are actually going to see this through tool installations and updates in support library. Right.
Yeah, it's a little bit confusing.
it's probably really just revealing our org chart, right? You work for a team that releases with Android M, but really here you're working on a tools feature.
Yeah, it's actually that was one of the nice parts of working on data mining because it's part of the framework, first of all, but you want to put it into a support library to make it available on all the platforms. But then tools integration is very important for data mining. Like without nice ID integration, it's not going to work well. So it touches a lot of components. But at the end, it's like this is a library we ship with our tools. And because support library is the common name for stuff that doesn't require the latest API, so you can say it's part of the support library, but this is actually a tool. Like data mining is a tool that works at the compile time of your application.
And so furthermore, it actually is a Gradle plugin, so it's part of more like Android Studio tools instead of, say, the AAPT, which comes with the SDK. So the question is, how do we get it? And that,
essentially, where are developers going to see this thing showing up? How do they get it and start to use it?
Just put one line into your Gradle file and then just don't care too much what's happening behind the scenes. You will find it. It's magic in the cloud.
More magic. Yeah. It's all about the magic.
Yeah, there's some libraries on JCenter that you'll get download automatically through Gradle, the Gradle plugin. Yeah.
So certainly in the show notes, we can link to the site for there must be an overview of data binding. An example is always good to start from. I assume that there's an example to point to as well.
That's right. There's
some snippets on that.
There's some snippets in the how to get started guide for data binding.
All right. Yeah. So we'll do that. And now back to your segue.
Well, no, I mean, we could talk more about data binding. I was just, making a joke because I know Yeet used to work on recycler view.
Yeah, I do.
And still does.
Apparently. Yep.
Is there ongoing work on recycler view?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was looking at the numbers, the amount of Optic Recycle took is incredible. Like so many applications are using it.
I don't know why they'd want to switch away from List View. It was such a solid,
beautiful API. Easy to work with, very flexible, fantastic for animations, very easy.
Yeah.
Chet loves ListView. Like whenever I have a CL, send it to Chet for review. He says, no, this is better than ListView. But yeah, it's like so many libraries on GitHub that actually makes me really happy because that's what we wanted with Recycly. Like the problem with ListView was that it's very hard to change. Like it's in its limits. And people want to customize.
Well, I think it was brilliant that you didn't put it in the platform.
Oh, the support library? Yeah.
Right. And because, you know, we have some other libraries. For example, Grid Layout is in both support library and in the platform. But it's like, you know, there are more features now in the one in the support library. Okay. Right? So we're actually dealing with two different implementations of Grid Layout that have different capabilities. And that's not great. And really, having everyone use the one, which in the case of Recycler would be with whatever the latest support library is probably better than some people happening to use the one that's in 21 if you had included it.
That's actually true, but now we are also facing the problem where inside the framework you cannot use Recycler Vim anymore because Recycler Vim depends on the framework.
When do you want to use Recycler Vim in the framework? It's just in what system UI?
I know. I was like receiving and like yeah, maybe system UI.
I'm thinking private copy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you look at the annotation, for example, all the support annotations are also in the framework, but they're hidden, right? And that's so that they can be used in the framework, but we don't want to expose those because you can't really depend on support library stuff in the framework, but annotations are clearly so important and vital to the health of Android.
Well, it's actually,
that, you know, it was worth duplicating. Yeah, I'm kidding. But you know, Recycler View could be kind of the same thing, right? If you really have a good need for it, you could make a private copy in the framework that they could use. But really, you want developers to use the external one that is going to be maintained.
You do. And like I totally agree. Like we should do as much as we can in the support library. Sometimes you need more new capabilities in the platform and then it doesn't make sense. But if we can put it in the support library, great, because obviously people care about earlier versions out there. But if every application is going to ship with a component and they all have to bundle that same code inside of their application, then at some point, like efficiency dictates, you should try to put it in a central place.
Shared libraries.
Oh. There is not that solution right now, right? Like right now, if you use the support library, yeah, then you're bundling that thing. So if it's really huge and if everybody's using it, then at what point do we try to make it a central shared resource through whatever the mechanism
is? Yeah, and I think if a component survives a test of 3 releases with no updates, okay, it's
three?
Solid.
Okay, so Tor says 3.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, is that MR0, MR1, and MR2?
That's 3 studio releases. You know, every two months, boom.
That's clever. We shall do that. Yeah, I mean, hopefully, I would like to merge the cycle back to the framework. If it was possible.
After that whole speech I just gave, that was your conclusion?
Unconvinced.
No, this because...
You're just telling me how you're continuing to work on it, which would be exactly the opposite of what I said. It was like, hey, once there's no more work, once it's perfect and there's no complaints.
That's why I said, I would like to do that. That means it's perfect.
Yeah. All right, it is perfect. All right, good.
So one of the tricks in making something like Recycler View work for support library outside of the framework is that it may depend on capabilities that really vary per release. So animations is certainly one of those, right? Like you really want, you know, nice smooth animations to take advantage of the capabilities that are not on every release that we want Recycler View. So then we end up with, you know, the same API, the same overall capabilities, but nuances about how that will behave. So for instance, Recycler View runs on V7, but it's not going to be using view property compat or view property animator compat. It will be using it, but basically those calls are stubbed out, so it's not going to animate those operations.
Exactly. Right? This is the weird part. Like it makes it really hard for us to work on it because like there's a lot of abstraction, so we have to shim out a lot of APIs that exist in newer platforms. And then you make a mistake, like it's easy to get the order of listeners you call wrong, and then someone receives a different behavior on older platform and then they cannot figure out what's going on in their application. This is really also hard for the developer. And it also makes testing harder. I mean, we have to do it. We do it because it's important for the health of the platform. It's just very annoying. I wish we didn't.
Yeah. Why couldn't you, why didn't you port animations down to V7?
Can I talk to my boss?
I'm just going to toss this hot potato back and forth. That one keeps coming up over and over again. But that's actually one of those that is not an easy thing to toss into the support library because it depends on platform capabilities that don't exist, right? So you could put a timing engine on any release you want, but what you're going to animate with that depends on the capabilities of the platform. So, for example, when we introduced the animator stuff and then view property animator, they depended on view properties like translation and scale and rotation that do not exist prior to that release. So, yeah, you can have an animation engine. Good luck using it on your UI because the things you want to animate aren't there.
And also the devices you're using, like Gingerbread devices, probably don't support animations very well anyway. They just aren't powerful enough, right?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, it's a little harder to know what the performance metrics
are. Everything looks fine at 10 frames per second.
Yes. Okay, so recycle review. And then as long as we're talking about animations, there's also stuff that George was working on prior to data binding. Yes, they actually had lives before data binding.
Yeah.
So
I was working on transitions and activity transitions specifically and fragment transitions. I don't know.
That's the material design thing, right? When you go from one activity to another and you could sort of do something cool.
Yeah, that's right. So when you're going from one activity to the other and you want to share some UI element between one and the other, then now you can. You can do that a lot easier now than before. Prior to this, you'd have to do some kind of magic to make an invisible activity and then try to share the bitmap between the activities and then have it maybe grow or shrink or move across the screen using your own custom animations. And the new system lets you do it with basically just you say, I want to use this transition and have it automatically go from one activity to the other. You just say, I want to share this element. And a lot of magic happens behind the scenes. Some really interesting parts, I don't know if you guys care about the difficulties I had to face when doing this. But imagine that you're transitioning activities, that all works fine, and then suddenly the user rotates the screen. And now your shared element is in a different location. Then you have to go back to a different place. So you have to have some kind of communication to tell it, oh, this is the new place it belongs. Or what if your shared element disappears completely? What do you do? And there's a lot of tricks.
And those cases all work now?
Yeah, those work now.
Nice.
Yeah, actually, this is like two transitions, one of the like most common recycle view bugs because they fight.
Yeah.
And we also fight with George, and our libraries also fight with each other.
Yeah, we put on boxing gloves every morning. I come over to his desk and I just start beating up on him.
Yeah, this isn't because like recycle view things, like same with data binding. Recycle view is like these views are mine, don't touch it. Okay, I can do whatever I want. And then layout transitions comes, no, like I'm going to animate this view, so give that to me. And then recycle view swaps it with another position and you have a bug.
In fact, we just saw one like that this morning or yesterday morning and it was amazing.
So to make sure I understand, so you're saying that in a recycler view, I can start swiping. I can delete something, and it's going to start animating the other children up. So it's setting. It's messing with the translate property. At the same time, if I'm switching activities, they are also touching the same translation properties, and they are each setting it to conflicting values. So it jumps back and forth. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that certainly would be a problem, but that's not usually the problem we see. Usually, the problem we see is where you imagine you're entering a new activity and you start the recycler view, but the recycler view is not ready yet. You have to lay everything out and maybe get some non-data changes in the middle of your first frame. What's going to happen is the transition framework is going to come in and say, oh, I see the view right here. I'm going to animate it to this new place. And then, oh, wait, here comes a non-data change. Boop, and now it's moved, but now it's not going to the same place I want it to go to.
I see. So we just have to make recycler view faster.
And the animations for recycler view faster.
No, it's actually this always happens when people call notify dataset change. So in recycler view, I mean, one of the problems with the list view animations was like list view has no idea what happened in the adapter. Uh-huh. You say my dataset has changed. I have no idea. List view is like, I don't know. Let's relay out everything now. And then in that case, it's really hard to animate anything because you don't know if it's the same thing or not.
Yep.
So in recycler view API, one of the things we introduced was, you got to tell us what happened in the adapter. You say, I added 5 items here. And then RecycleView knows, okay, these are the only 5 things I need to care about. And if they're not even visible, I'm like, I don't need to change anything. Perfect. So this gives you performance. Mm-hmm. And plus, we can nicely animate what happened. So like the bug we were looking at was happening because the application was calling notify dataset change, and RecycleView has no idea where that item is now. It just recycles.
The notify data set changed, that's saying, hey, the world changed.
Yeah, hey, the world changed. So if you say that, like, we're sorry, cannot do anything for that.
And there's also there's a fundamental problem in particular with ListView, but it also kicks in when RecyclerView doesn't know what to do because, you know, the world changed, which is that all of these animations, transitions, animators work on views, right? You are targeting the view, you're changing the properties of that view, and then along comes an adapter view that replaces that view with something else, right? Now it's using that view somewhere else because it recycled the content and like it threw out all the old views, it puts them in a cache, and then it grabs them back and it puts them in ListView's case, at least random places, right? It's just grabbing views wherever, you know, off the top of the cache and putting it back in. And in the meantime, you were in the middle of animating that thing. So these are sort of inherently in conflict. The more information that RecyclerView has, the better job it can do about retaining the views with their prior content. But in some cases, it just doesn't have that information, and then it's going to butt heads with the animations.
And so for data binding, do you have special ways of for lists indicating what changed, what range of elements were inserted, deleted, or is that sort of up to the developer?
We do have a notification system for that. Right now, we don't use it so much because in data binding, what we're doing is binding to a specific element in your list. So we'll know when that element changed.
I see. So you deal mostly with scalers. It's not really, okay.
Yeah. I mean, also for recycler and data binding, we thought about this and we realized it's best to leave it to the recycler view. So if you think about data binding is responsible to provide the collection to recycler view. And a recycler view is responsible to bring the views.
Yep.
Each of which has their own data binder.
Right.
And then that view handles binding itself to the raw.
So I know that in previous years at Google I.O., there was always a list view talk, right? How to make list view work.
Yep.
I haven't seen one for recycler view. Is that, I guess that's a sign of success?
Yeah, just... yeah. Let's put it that way. I like this.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just works.
It just works.
I think it's because talking about technical things at I.O. is less
popular. Ooh, burn.
Oh, who wants to go to those kind of talks? I mean, I think to some extent, it's not that, you know, RecyclerView solved all the problems or is super easy. It is fairly complex if you want to customize it, but I think part of the goal of the architecture of RecyclerView was to make it pluggable and more modular so you could actually customize the pieces that you want. So with the list view, you either took what it gave you and that's all you could do, or if you want to customize it, you were kind of off and writing your own, right, completely from scratch. And it had all kind of idiosyncrasies in how it behaved and getting it to do, you know, tricky things like, you know, animations or not bumping into various artifacts that you could see if you did the wrong thing. Like, then we had to explain like how everything worked on the inside. With the recycler view, it's like, well, we give you a bunch of stuff that you can just kind of take, and it's very customizable from the outside. Just, you know, we have layout managers that will actually do both horizontal and vertical lists.
And grids, my goodness.
Who knew that people would want that? Grid-based stuff. Like, so we give you a lot of power out of the box, and then if you want to customize it, you only have to know about, like, the piece that you care about. You can write your own layout manager. We have a bunch of layout managers you can start from. If you want to write your own adapter, then, you know, here's the adapter interface. So I think it's a little easier to approach.
Right. And that reminds me, I think fairly recently added the ability to say, hey, I want to use a list from the XML, right? So now you can actually have a list without going in and doing stuff in code.
No, not yet. You can only do it with data binding.
You can set the layout manager from code, which is new.
That is what gives you the thing that I talked about, right? Or is there anything else that's
needed?
Well,
the data is not.
You also need the data.
I see data, yeah.
Remember, that's the first word.
Chet and I are basically like, we write shell apps. You know, he does animations. I just like, hey, did it compile? All right, good.
Well, like one of the common requests we receive is like, or when people complain, they're like, ListView does this, why can't RecyclerView? Like, this is terrible.
I love this bug report.
This is one of the side effects of being so flexible that RecyclerView cannot make some assumptions. Like, ListView knows how to put items. It controls everything. RecyclerView doesn't control anything. So, like, some of the things that ListView can easily do, like, RecyclerView cannot. It's up to the layout manager, and then some of the responsibilities are now belong to the item animator. And
well, could you make a subclass, you know, or some customization of RecyclerView that is called ListView?
Yeah, many people.
That basically simulates.
Yeah, many people did that. I was actually thinking about doing it. We were going to.
I mean, from the tool's perspective, it would be nice, right? Because what I want to drag in from the palette is not RecyclerView and go and mess with like what I want to drag in a horizontal or a vertical ListView.
I think the way we
could customize it. So when you drag it in, you get a recycler view with some attributes on it. But like, that's logically what I want to do.
But you can drag a layout manager.
That's not a widget. So it just feels all wrong. Currently, everything, I mean, we could do this, right? But it's weird. A first drag in a generic recycly thing. I mean, other than being good for the environment, it's not really clear, like, why would I need
this
a recycle?
Like,
and then
never,
I would drag a second layout mesh on top of it?
No, you never drag the recycle view. You only drag the layout mesh. It comes with the recycle view preset.
Yeah, I think what we'll do, I mean, we already have the ability to drag in, like, text field or edit text, I guess. You know, we have 20 of it on the palette. They're all edit text just with different input type set. Because we really want to encourage people to set input type, right? Because it's really bad to have a text field with no input type. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you set it to phone number or name or whatever, it's going to do the right keyboard for you. So we could do that. We could have multiple recycle views. Just call them, hey, horizontal, vertical, list, whatever. And that's my we might want to do that. But I mean, hearing what you're saying about how people want list view behavior on this widget, it might be nice to have one that just kind of exposes that.
Okay, so feature request.
Yeah.
All right.
That's what we do on the show.
It already exists in the framework called this view.
So I actually that's a good point. Like, as much as we rail on list view and say, you know, recycler view is a better way forward, if list view is working for you, there's no reason to throw away that code and rewrite it in recycler view. Yeah. Go ahead and use list view. It works. It has idiosyncrasies, but if they work for you right now, they will continue to work for you.
But I'm thinking list view with nice animations. Right? I mean, that's kind of, and that should be possible to do fairly simply with recycler view, right? It's not so simple with list view.
It is not. There are several videos explaining how you can do different portions of this one at a time.
I should do 5-second videos how you do it with a second.
Yeah. Just to show off and rub it in. So thanks for that.
On data binding again, can we talk a little bit more about the tool support? And I know that I'm going to look guilty now, right? Because, you know, there's maybe not everything that needs to be there in Studio that should be there. But because I know that you worked on Studio, you know, I reviewed many of the CLs. So what are the things you've added to support data binding in the IDE?
So there's actually two things. One of them is called highlighting in the XML, which your team, Dipanshi, implemented. Mm-hmm. And that was the other part where we're generating these magical classes. If you don't see them in your code, it's very hard to use. Like, you don't really want to recompile your application. So
this is like the R class, the fact that the IDE can pretend there is an R class and show you the available fields. So you're saying that there's something similar for
exactly.
The binding?
So when you have a layout file that has a layout tag, mm-hmm. So you know there's data binding there. Inside the IDE, we are going to virtually create that class. The cool part is, as soon as you define a view in your layout file, you put an IDE, mm-hmm. Your binding class will instantly have that field available for
without
you
having to compile it or anything.
And then even further, you can say, like, if you have, let's say I have a input text, mm-hmm. And you can just mouse click on that, go to the layout file from the Java code.
Nice. So there's declaration that direction.
Yeah, and we know the references. And I think it's very important that there's a lot we have to do.
So what are the top requests from users of this in terms of tool support right now?
Getting cont completion in the XML.
Okay.
Writing expressions, because in the expression you are referencing back to your code.
Yeah, so right now we have syntax highlighting only, so it doesn't do symbol resolution, right?
Exactly.
So if I refer to a symbol that doesn't exist, does it highlight that as red, or there's like nothing?
No, it doesn't know. Okay. It has no idea that.
So you have to compile, and you'll get a compile error, and then you realize, okay, there's a problem here.
And another error you might see is if you, for example, use the less than sign in your expression. that sounds just fine, but when part of XML, that can give you a nice error, and it comes out as compile error.
Okay. But that seems like Studio should be able to right now highlight as the XML parser should already complain about this, I would think.
Yeah, we should totally talk to the tools team.
Yeah.
Is there anybody around? Do we know anybody?
When there is a binding error, does it point to an error in the generated code, or do you map it back to XML so that like I can click on it and I'm right at
I have a pending CL for that.
Oh, all right, good.
Yeah. In the case of the less than sign, though, it's a compile error, and it points to the right place in the XML.
I'm glad that it does that, too. But I'm thinking that I can't imagine that you could write invalid XML in the XML editor and like not. I would think the generic XML editor would say, "Hey, this is bad." That's my guess.
Yeah. So that part works. I mean, if your XML is not valid, it's even before data binding that it receives.
But it seems like all these other errors. Like if I refer to a property that doesn't exist, there's no warning to me in the editor. It's not until I compile that I see that.
Exactly.
That's bad.
So when you compile. If you compile from the command line, we try to give you the file name and the location of where the error happened.
I work on Studio. So command line, I don't care.
Okay, so if you run it from the Studio will be able to understand it soon.
All right.
I mean, you have to look at the logs right now, but we print it in a way that Studio can handle. And once we get in that CL, I think that will help a lot. And then with the code completion, actually another major feature request was refactoring. So when you change one of the name of your fields, you want data binding expressions to update themselves as well.
Like yep. This is important. Yeah, I had someone look at that this week. So yeah.
Perfect. Good news, data binding people.
That's right.
It's coming to the studio.
So still a work in progress. So the basic functionality of data binding, like all the plumbing pieces, are essentially done, you know, modulo, smaller stuff that we're continuing to think about. But the tools integration stuff is coming along.
It's a work in progress.
Yes.
Team collaboration.
Yeah, it's significant effort. I mean, yeah. it's really, especially for a data binding project, there's a lot to do in the studio, and we cannot easily reuse the work we did in the compiler side. Like, Studio IntelliJ has a totally different model, where yep. like everything is lazily evaluated. It took me a while to learn how it works.
Yeah, performance in the editor is so important that there's a lot of smarts in IntelliJ to be very clever about it. And if you think about the syntax highlighting too, that's nested syntax highlighting. That is highlighting inside of a different language, right? Which is kind of tricky. Because you want to deal with like, hey, in XML, you escaped this ampersand with this thing. But really, when you pass it to this parser, it needs to be the actual ampersand, not the escaped. You know, there's all this stuff that has to happen. Yep. So it's tricky. But that part is actually working. So now it's just a small matter of code completion and refactoring.
Yeah.
Just, what is this? Small matter of programming? Small.
Yes.
So it's just tiny little issues.
All right.
Did we forget anything?
I'm out of questions. Are you out of answers?
What will be in data binding next, George? Do you have some idea?
Oh yeah, what are your release plans actually? And you know, what dates can you commit to here now?
So that's all for this week. Look for more stuff soon. I will post links to the various things we talked about. Anything else to add?
Nope.
Well, you said that you're working on some bug fixes, right? That should be out very soon.
Yeah, there's small changes. It's pretty much final.
How often have you been releasing in the past?
This would be our third release.
Third release, okay, and that's since May.
Yes.
Okay.
And the way that people, so going back to my previous tedious topic, the way that people would actually get those fixes, like if they want to stay, you know, tip a tree to the latest, greatest data binding stuff coming out, are they getting incremental versions like canary builds of Studio? Or is Studio going to automatically pull it down from the library?
We don't do that. We used to basically do that where we put dynamic dependencies in. So we'd say, hey, support library version number plus. Plus means get me the latest. That turned out to be a really bad idea for multiple reasons. One of them is that it hits the network every 24 hours. And some people would say, hey, Studio's so slow, I'm building. And it turns out they had a slow proxy, right? Or some network congestion that would just make things very slow. The other one is that builds would sometimes break because especially when you use plus at the top level, not like 23.0.plus. You know, versions sometimes change and your code stops compiling. So now we always insert like an actual literal number. And instead, we give you a lint warning when there's a newer version available. So you can at your leisure go and say, yeah, actually, I want to update to this version that's now available.
Okay. So I understand that.
Yeah.
So then the answer is?
Well, we have a version. Right now it's 1.0-RC1. And when it comes time for the next version, it'll be 1.0-RC2.
And how would people know when that thing is out so they can get it?
That is
through
a good
lint warning in the tool?
Yeah, we should.
Or is there a site where you update this?
I don't think we look at plugin versions. We do it for our plugin, for the Android Gradle plugin. I didn't realize that there's this other plugin we ship. So it would be very, very easy for us. So this is another feature request. After this, let's go and just add it. It should be very trivial for us to say, hey, we should look for this specific plugin.
Okay.
In fact, since we're working on features on this podcast, we ship an offline version of a Gradle repository so that people can create new projects with Studio without needing a network. Because it used to be the problem is the first time you use Studio, it would take forever to create the project because it has to download all the Gradle dependencies. And so you'd already downloaded Studio, you know, 200 megabytes or whatever, and then you hit run and you're in a bad network. And I experienced this once when I was traveling. And, you know, it takes forever and some people give up. So now instead, when we build a stable version of Studio, we take the latest version of all of our dependencies and we bake it into like this local Gradle repository that we point to. We probably should have the data binding plugin in that as well so that you can use the data binding plugin without having to hit JCenter or whatever.
So what I'm hearing is that you need a new version of Android Studio to use the next version of, to know about the next version of data binding?
Or until that's out there, because that's a feature request. So
we do announcements.
You do announcements to?
Through Android.
Yeah, look for Yeatboyer at twitter.com or something.
Yeah, tweet about it. I'll share it on G+.
Okay.
Then maybe on my Facebook? No.
So all of Yeet's friends will know when the latest one comes out.
We will tell Chet, and he will put it on G+.
Okay. There's the official data binding announcement mechanism. That's not the one I expected. Yeah. All right.
The alternative way will be, I'm assuming, probably optimistically, but I'm assuming that all of our listeners are, not only using Anode Studio, they're using the latest version. They're staying on the Canary channel. And in an upcoming Canary channel, and of course they also run Lint as part of Studio. You go to the Analyze menu and say Inspect Code. And, if you do that on a regular basis, it'll suddenly tell you, hey, you're using an older version of the data binding plugin, so you should update it. And you'll click yes, and then it'll do it.
So
stay up to date on Studio, and you'll get a warning eventually.
Do you think that's how most developers find out about the latest versions of whatever libraries they're using? Is through Lint warnings in Studio?
There is no other way other than for you to go in and try. Like, you could go to Maven Central and search for artifacts yourself.
Yeah.
But there might be some third-party Gradle plugins that do this as well. But certainly Lint does it. And it's integrated in the IDE with quick fixes.
Or you could, every time you build, every day, start of every day, you go in and you increment the dot versions on all your libraries just to see if it builds. And if it did, then that version must be available.
Well, actually, here's a special tip for our listeners. There is also, so what we do right now is we check all the versions of the support library, so all the things that are available locally, because we can check that without a network connection. There is a Lint check which actually connects to Maven Central and searches all your artifacts. And that one is off by default because, it could be a slow check, right? And so that's a rule you can go in and find and turn on. And when you turn it on, you actually can run this Lint check and it'll tell you if anything has anything new, any third-party Maven dependency you're using, not just the ones that are shipping in the local Maven repositories.
Okay. So that's a useful tip. Where would they?
It is. It doesn't really affect data binding because we're going to ship it, but yes.
Okay. Cool. I think that's it. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
We got to give him a chance to say something. We always let our, interview. Yeah. Yeah. What would you like to share with mankind?
Mankind? Can I say hi to my mom?
I think you just did.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Perfect. Hi, mom.
George, something really wise and intelligent?
You're asking the wrong person for that.
Very clever. Okay. Thanks.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.